A slight digression today.
Welcome to Coffee with Creamer, where you get to sit down with our host, Dr. Barry Creamer, for a conversation about faith, life, and culture. We'll look at old ideas through a new lens, turn those culture wars on their head, and paint a picture of the way things could be. If you like your thinking deep and your coffee hot, pull up a chair. You're in the right place.
When I say a slight digression, what I mean is that today we're starting a new series for Coffee with Creamer that we're calling From the Producer's Desk.
I'm Daisy, and from this side of the desk, I get to notice gaps. What's missing, what's implied, and what might be worth exploring a little further. I also get to keep an eye on things from your side of the conversation, raising the questions you might be thinking, and pushing where something feels unfinished. And, of course, I get to do what producers everywhere secretly enjoy, which is gently, or not so gently, pummeling Barry with questions and topics that may or may not have been on the original plan. This series is meant to be a little more flexible. Some episodes will lean into theology, others into culture or philosophy, and a lot of them will probably live somewhere in the tension between all three. The goal isn't to make this feel like a program, but more like an ongoing conversation that follows ideas wherever they lead. And we'd love for you to be a part of that. If you have a topic or a question you'd like us to take up on a future episode, you can email me at mail@barrycreamer.com. So here's today's idea. Humanity can't seem to quit religion. For a long time, the expectation was that as we became more educated, more scientific, and more enlightened, religion would slowly disappear. But that hasn't really happened. Instead, we've watched it lose influence in some spaces while quietly reappearing in others. History shows even when we reject formal belief, we don't stop doing the things that religion does. We still look for meaning, still build communities around shared convictions, still divide the world into what's sacred and what's not. We still want purpose, identity, and some kind of transcendence, even if we're not always sure what we mean by that. And when those things aren't grounded in traditional religion, they tend to reattach themselves elsewhere. So maybe the real question isn't why religion survives, it's why we seem unable to live without it, and whether that says more about religion or about us.
Okay, so when I saw this question, this topic, really, I mean, it's not the producer, Daisy, it's not her question. She's asking it for your sake on behalf of the audience that she thinks I have given short shrift concerning this matter. I've brought up a lot of these topics over time, but I haven't put it together into a coherent idea, nor communicated it, and so we'll see how coherent we can make it today. The question of why, ultimately, really, not just why religion exists in one of the forms that she gave it to me originally, it was why secularism never succeeds at replacing religion or at killing religion. It just keeps lingering on. And so there are a couple of things that I would do to approach this question, part of which is just or to address what secularism is. And so we'll address that in a moment. But probably the first question, you know, that you have to answer in order to address this overall topic is simply why religion would fail in the face of secularism. Why you wouldn't expect it necessarily to just be an ongoing dualistic relationship, and you have your way of seeing the world, and we have ours, and we're just going to coexist throughout all of history, and that would seem to be a normal way to do a lot of things. There are whole dualist philosophies and dualist religions. So one question would be why we would presume, and it is a presumption in a lot of secularism, why we would presume that religions would fail, or why we would expect religions to fail. And there are a couple of different ways to ask that question, or at least to address that question. One would be on the basis that you presume that religion is true, that the claims of religion are true, that its doctrines or practices actually lead towards some inexorable conclusion about the reality of the universe and so on. If it's true, if religion is true, has a real basis, a foundation in reality, then the question would take on the form in which I would normally address it. In other words, if I wanted to give an answer on the basis, well, you know, religion relates us to God and he just refuses to go away, then I would answer the question differently than I am going to today. And that is obviously a good answer. I think it's an important and valid answer because not only do I believe in God, you know, I believe in Jesus and the resurrection. So it's if I were to address it on the basis that of religion's truth, then I would, you know, what I would do is theology. Well, this is the nature of God, and so he, you know, persists in presenting himself and revealing and so on. Or evangelism. Well, let me tell you how great this news is, and it would be something that would convert you to want to, you know, and so on. Or apologetics. Well, let me give you an argument about why your confusion over the nature of religion or its claims can actually be explained away, and you can feel compatible between your science and, you know, whatever. Then I would do apologetics. And I've done all of those in different formats. I don't think that's the goal today. It's not where I understood this lapse to exist in the things we've talked about in the past. It would more be along the lines of why we would assume religion would fail in the face of secularism if it were untrue. And we don't have to make the case that it's untrue. I don't believe it is untrue, obviously. But if it were untrue, we would have a reason to assume that religion would fail. So let me put it in a specific sense and then in a more generic sense. In the specific sense, you know, if we were talking about a particular religion, why didn't Buddhism fail? Why hasn't Hinduism failed? Why hasn't, you know, whatever, Islam failed? Why haven't Christianity or Judaism failed? And so on. If I were to try to pick those out one religion at a time and say, why has that religion not failed? And then say, well, you know, on presumption, I would think it would fail as long as we discover the truth. Part of the reason for saying in the specific sense that religions are untrue is sort of a universal claim to begin with, because on the grounds of most religions, the claim that all the other religions are false is sort of built into their religion. And in that case, you would expect if a religion's falsity were to contribute to its failure overall in the future, then you would expect every religion to fail pretty soon, because they're all wrong except one, apparently. And I don't mean by that that every religion does that, but I mean, come on. Most religions are pretty exclusive in one way or another. So if you put it in the specific sense, it would sort of make sense to say, oh, yeah, it's because they're false. That's why they would fail. In the generic sense, then what you would mean by this is if the religion is untrue, what you would mean by that statement is none of the religions are true. They're all pointing at this vacuous idea that we have of something actually existing in the sky that doesn't exist in the sky, which is exactly the kind of mocking language that I've heard about what we're talking about with religion. On that basis, if no religion is true, then, well, first of all, most of us don't hold that view. And I should pause here and make the point that we're not talking, religion and the belief in God are not the same thing. Religion is a cultural and social expression about something. We'll talk about the something in a minute, but it's not the same thing as simply believing in God. So there's a distinction between the idea of atheism and the claim that no religion is true. There is a distinction that can be made. And so, like Buddhism, you know, at least in early forms of Buddhism, there's no God present in it. So it's not a contest between theism and, you know, atheism in this question. It's a question about whether religion would persist if it were false, including the kinds of religion that aren't really focused on a God, but on something else. And if you say, what else, then I'll explain that in just a moment. But in either case, whether it's the specific religion or the general idea of religion and, you know, and so on, one would think that if they were untrue, religion's failures over time, which, again, don't take, I'm not trying to assault religion. I believe in God. I'm a Christian. I'm a follower. But religion's failures over time, but in this case, we'd be saying because it is false, would lead to a rejection of its claims. And let's face it, religion does seem to fail at times. A lot, actually. False religions, obviously. Every time there's a war, we prayed to our God, we prayed to our God, and one God just didn't come through. Something's up with that. So you would think religion fails nations in war, it fails regions when famines and droughts and pestilences come. I mean, we offered our son up as a sacrifice, and we still didn't get a crop this year. You know, what are we supposed to do? It's happened throughout all of history. And none of that claim, what I'm saying right now, if it seems insulting to you, if you've been listening to our series on the Psalms at all, or hearing the episodes that we've done where we just go through the Psalms, none of this is a surprise to Christianity or to Judaism. In fact, it seems to be a point of the book. Why is it we're constantly looking for, this seems to be the point of the book, why is it we're constantly having to look for God to intervene when we know he could intervene now? God, when, how long, O Lord? You know, all of those questions seem to be posing that same issue and putting it in front of us as well as in front of God. So it's not a big surprise. And yet, you know, with all of that, the presumption that it does make sense that religion would fail after people try it and try it and try it and it doesn't work for what they want it to do, that eventually they would just reject it and say, no, I'm done with this. And yet, religion persists. I mean, here it is. Most people believe. Everywhere, in almost every form, religion just keeps existing. And even if you're like I am, completely committed to one form of religion, to Christianity, as the truth that leads all of us to where we ought to go in our worship to God and so on, even if you believe all of that, you know, looking around the world, all the other religions are still going strong. It's not like they have ceased to exist after thousands of years of trial and error and several hundred years now of the scientific method saying, well, if you just finally apply the scientific method to your religion, you'll realize it's false. We've had centuries to give that a try, and everybody's still getting on their knees on Sunday or on Saturday, depending on who they are. The point is, it's still everywhere. So what's going on with this? And in fact, it persists so much so that one of the ways we characterize genocide is by the elimination of a religion. It's such an important cultural identifier that the religion only dies when the whole people have died. And that goes both directions. You are eliminating the identity of a people group when you eliminate their religion. That's how strongly it's attached to people groups, even in our definition of genocide. So there are, you know, there are all kinds of reasons that we can do that. And there are negative responses. People have negative responses when religion fails. If you're the prophet that said, you're going to win this war, and then you lost the war, you're probably getting stoned to death. That may take different forms, but you know what I'm talking about in the Jewish context. Of the false prophet who says this thing, but it does not come to pass, then they're executed. And cynics do arise. They rise to, you know, be these strong critics of religion, and it can happen in the satirical form of a Voltaire or in the polemics of somebody like a Freud. But it's always there. It's even if there's a negative response, there's still this thing there that you recognize is something you're unhappy with, and it takes this religious form. I think it shows up in a particularly cynical author, brilliant, beautiful, cynical author, Stephen Crane, in his Open Boat, which I've probably referred to in some episode previously because I love this passage, and I love that short story. It's fantastic. It doesn't communicate what we want to hear, but it communicates it so beautifully. It's worth understanding. Anyway, in the middle of this episode, in the middle of this short story by Stephen Crane, these people are, you know, being threatened with death, and they're really feeling frustrated. And the author, who's personified in one of the characters, says, sort of as a narrator for us, when it occurs to a man that nature does not regard him as important because they're in an open boat out in the sea and they're, you know, it's really frustrating. The waves just keep coming and there's no one offering help. And it's as if no one cares about them. And now he realizes even nature doesn't care whether they exist or not. It's not like nature's rising up in anger against him. It just doesn't care. All of that on his mind, he says, when it occurs to a man that nature does not regard him as important and that she feels she would not maim the universe by disposing of him, he at first wishes to throw bricks at the temple, and he hates deeply the fact that there are no bricks and no temples. Any visible expression of nature would surely be pelleted with his jeers. He's looking for someone to hate and can't even find anyone. That's genuine, cynical anger, but in a really potent artistic form with God and with religion, and then saying, and it just isn't true. It's just not there. So there are negative responses. There is a pushback, and yet here it is. In fact, so present that Crane feels like he needs to include, I want to throw a brick at that temple where everyone worships, but there is no temple, meaning there is no God to fight against. But he had to bring it up because it's still there for him to fight against in that story. So I'm not even criticizing Stephen Crane. I'm just pointing out that no matter what we do with it, it's still there. The thing we know just won't go away. And why is that? So let's go back to the issue of why we think it would go away. And to understand that, we need to understand part of what secularism is about. Because, again, underlying, sort of in the foundation of this issue today, is why religion persists in the face of secularism, why secularism has not killed it. So what do we mean by secularism? There's so many different forms for this. I'll try to be brief and not use up all the time on discussing secularism. But a couple of different ways I'll take it, instead of the four or five that I originally had thought we might do. First of all, expressed in government, secularism looks something like, and I'll use the two examples we're probably most familiar with, the French example and the American example for secularism. The French example being this sort of activist secularism is the way some people put it. But it's where, as in France, the goal is to protect the state, not just the government, but the state from religious interference. So we don't want a Catholic nation anymore. That's the idea in France. And so we want to protect the state from this religious identification. And the implication of that is that we need to protect the public square from religious influence as well. And that's why you hear stories every once in a while about French laws that are passed or adopted that are controversial and that, you know, Amnesty International will take up an opposition to or something like that. I'm not mocking or taking a negative approach to Amnesty International. I know they do some things you probably love and some things you probably think are way too liberal, but they're always out there advocating for human rights. They don't do anything but that. Now, you can disagree with what the human rights are, but I mean, that's what they're advocating for. And in this case, you will hear them object to a French law banning the hijab or a full-faced veil on Muslim women or the abaya, you know, the long gown that some Muslim women wear in different contexts for, I don't know, modesty or religious expression or whatever it is that motivates it. But the point is, in French schools, for instance, those will be banned. You can't wear them to the public schools because they feel like it would be too great an imposition of the religion of Islam, in this case, on the public square. Oddly and sadly, it does become, you know, it can become very particular to a religion. And so it can become sort of anti-immigrant in its flavor. Whether that's the case in France or not doesn't matter. That's not the point for today. The point is, in their culture, they actually think the whole public square needs to be protected from any religious expression. And if you say, well, it's the same way it is in America, that's actually not the same thing that we have, even though there are interpretations that some people take about the freedom of religion that's, you know, the no establishment clause of the First Amendment, things like that. People will interpret that in a way, it finds its way into American practice, that actually matches more the way France describes and defines what religious freedom is about than the way we have historically done it in America. And, you know, right now, very few people would take this approach. No, that's not true. Half the culture would, but they're not the outspoken half right this moment. But it happens all the time. And the idea is that they think, oh, no, you can't have, you know, we can't say anything anywhere public about religion at all. The whole nature of interpreting religious freedom that way in America has shown itself at football games and in public schools and all that kind of stuff. But in a more moderate setting, in most places in America where you go, it's not a problem when somebody takes a Bible into a school and prays, has a time of prayer, even uses a classroom to pray or something like that at a certain time, until people start to make some kind of stink about it, and then it becomes a big controversy. But it's not presumed in the historically or traditionally understood way of interpreting religious freedom in America. It's just not the way it was. The American differentiation is of the state from religion. It's more passive than the French approach. That's what it's been historically, saying the government shouldn't do anything, and this is the Establishment Clause, to establish a religion of any kind, you know, any kind of institution of religion. So no establishment of religion. That's the idea, and that's how the First Amendment puts it. And effectively, it means in America, the approach was that the government should just be neutral toward religion. But all of that, you know, that neutrality in the minds of someone who isn't religious was enough to say, if we create an even footing, religion's going to be on its back foot, because religion doesn't bring the same value that science or economy brings. Religion doesn't bring the value that industry and entrepreneurial enterprise brings. How's that for redundancy? Anyway, the point is that, you know, that secularism of either of those forms would bring it about, because the government would no longer be sort of the protectorate of the religious form. So you wouldn't be collecting tithes in order to protect the church, as you do in other nations that are specifically religious. If you're in England, Anglican. If you're in Germany, Lutheran, whatever it is. So our idea of a secular state, whether actively like in France or passively like here in America, seems to open the door for religion to fail. Certainly, if it's not true, you would expect it to decline. But even if it is true, you know, you can push out, you would think you could push out religion with a lot of prosperity. And maybe in some ways we have. We'll talk about that another day, too. If we were to talk about secularism, not in government, but historically, then I think we have the real impetus for understanding why people would assume religion would disappear over time. And I think that was what was implied in the way Daisy actually worded her introduction today. The Enlightenment's project is literally a project, and I'm taking this basically from Alistair MacIntyre back in the 1980s, to seek answers without appealing to God. That's ultimately the goal in the Enlightenment. We want to stop saying, because God. You know, why is the sky blue? Because God made it that way. Why is it thundering? Because God is rolling bowling balls. You know, we wanted to stop saying stuff like that and start giving some kind of rationally interpretable understanding of how things happened. And so we create laws and principles, and we use those to interpret and define. And so everything becomes non-theistic. And it doesn't matter whether there is a God or not. The way we describe it becomes natural over time. So we do it with physics, and I've done whole episodes on this, so I'm not going to stick on the Enlightenment, but whole, you know, the whole transition from Galileo and Newton giving us a physics that's non-spiritual, that just has material forces that are acting, particles in motion, if you're Galileo, and so on, and Laplace. If we just know where all the particles are, then we'll know where everything's going to be in the future, if we could know that, and so on. And then biology with Darwin, and then psychology with Freud. Everything becomes demystified. Everything becomes this thing that doesn't need to appeal to God. So obviously, if you're a theist, you basically become a functional deist. Yeah, there's a God, but he's not doing anything. Or if he is doing anything, we don't need to know what it is, because we can understand it without referring to him, and so on. You would expect in an environment like that for religion to lose its footing. And very many people have interpreted history and the fact that the percentages of people who identify themselves with a specific religious belief are going down, they interpret that in light of what secularism has done for exactly that reason. So it would be inevitable. It would be inevitable that there would be that kind of decline of religion's presence in our thinking, since our explanations about life become inherently less religious. And so, you can talk about the reality that there are thinkers who expressed this. Sigmund Freud, The Future of an Illusion. Religion is certainly an illusion, but science is not, is his ideology, or what he expresses at least at the end of the book, The Future of an Illusion. For Marx, religion becomes simply this opium of the masses. This is the thing that's used to keep people in a position where they can whatever. Or a Weber, whose sociology is saying that other sciences and disciplines are replacing religious authority. Education, which historically happened through the church, they were the most educated, they were the ones who provided it, becomes secular. Law, which is established by the Old Testament or by the agreement of the religious authorities, these are the laws we follow. All of those become secular. It's the second law that rules our land now, not the law of God, but the law of the secular. It's these laws of the civil nation. And there's also, one other aspect that takes place through the Enlightenment and also through Romanticism. They both work together to do this. And it's the presumed move, and I think it's presumed. I do think this one is an oversight, and it's part of why religion doesn't disappear. But on the side of why you would expect religion to disappear under secularism, the presumed move is for religion to become more internal. It used to be that we had to come by herd and mass to the Catholic Church for, and I'm not condemning Catholics, that's just the church that was there in prominence. So, you had to come to the Mass in order to receive the forgiveness and the confession, the body and the blood and so on. And you were just doing it as the flock, as the herd that would show up. But now religion is a personal experience. We understand the light of reason existing within every man. And now we've translated the Bible into the idioms of the people. And so in the vulgar languages, we can understand the Bible ourselves. Why do we need a priest? And now I have a relationship with God myself. It's by faith and it's direct and it's personal and so on. And so religion moves from being a source of external community, that is unifying us together as one because of our relationship to God through this religious expression, religion moves from being that, a source of external community, to being a source of private, internal, introspective significance, meaning, and so on like that. And I'm not mocking that either, but I am saying you get the idea of the inward turn. So now it's about what God is saying to me personally, not what I'm doing with everyone else in my community. And as that change happens, religion loses a very significant portion of what made it inherently valuable to every culture throughout history. And that was its ability to put people together into a community. Here we agree on our values. Here we agree on our practices. Here's when we do it. So even in terms of social expressions, religion became fundamental to everything. So people lived in religiously unified communities. When that changes, of course, religion loses some of its footing, good, bad, or indifferent. It would lose some of its footing, and you would think to yourself, maybe it's going to fail. So the remaining question is simply why it doesn't. it certainly hasn't failed. And you can say to yourself, I don't know, there just aren't nearly as many people who believe in God now. You may find percentages in studies of people, more people identify as atheist or more people or whatever. But religion, it hasn't gone away even remotely. And the expression of it, while changing, no doubt changing, is still prolifically available and pervasive in the culture and for individuals. In some ways we know, and in some ways we don't. So that's what I want to mention. So why on earth is religion finding its way through? So first of all, let's clarify what we mean by religion. So defining religion sociologically, I've done this before, so I won't spend very long on it. But I love to use the elements that Catherine Albanese talks about: creed, code, cultus, and community. There are other lists of 7 or 10 characteristics that sort of make religion what it is. But if you get beyond those four, no matter how long or short the list might be, it's usually, at least 5 out of these 7, or at least, you know, so many out of this, and you're using more generic. Doing these four really gets the point across. Creed, we actually believe something in religion. You're holding on to some set of doctrines. Code, there is a set of practices that are associated with it. Usually a moral code is what we're talking about. So you have certain expectations of behavior that are associated with religion. You have cultus, it becomes highly cultus meaning it becomes highly symbolic. We think of that often in liturgical expression, in rituals, and so on. Again, I've done whole conversations on this in previous episodes, so I'm being brief. But then the other characteristic is community. Religions always have a community. I remember people being surprised when I was teaching a course on religion in America at Texas Woman's University ages ago, 25 years ago. And one of the things we talked about was community and how it was always expressed in community. And I asked them to write a paper, go visit some community that was religious, and then come back having written a paper about their experience in that religious community. And one person went to the atheist church that was meeting in Irving at the time. I don't even know if they're meeting there now. I think they called themselves free thinking something or another, whatever it was. And, you know, they were shocked. I mean, they had hymn singing. They had all the stuff that would go with being a regular church. But they called themselves, I'm saying regular, you know what I mean. But they called themselves an atheist church. And they were a church unified in their rejection of the existence of God. But they were very committed to the practice of religion that showed up in that community that they had. And with some of the cultists that was there. And they did agree on some doctrine, creed, and so on. So it's a fairly fascinating reality that religion doesn't have to be expressed in terms of a single set of beliefs. Now, again, I'm not talking about the religion. I'm not talking about Christianity. We're just talking about religion generically today. That's the idea. If we were to talk about it instead of sociologically, more psychologically, then we could say with other thinkers, it's our way of valuing most deeply. Plenty of people have expressed that opinion. I think I could point out the original one, but I'm not sure I'd get it right, so I'm not going to say it right now. But psychologically, you could say it's our way of valuing most deeply. And you can identify with that. You know what I'm talking about. Whatever it is we hold as the most important thing is the center of our religion. It's our way of understanding what the religion is, and it sort of imbues everything else with a different meaning because of how we value that thing. Just as I value Jesus Christ in that way. I value the relationship I have with God in that way. So anyway, psychologically, it's our way of valuing most deeply. I value Jesus Christ that way. It's our way of valuing most deeply. You know what I'm talking about. So that's psychologically. Experientially, which you could say is psychologically, but I mean it slightly differently. Experientially, more on the emotional side of the psyche. Is our experience encountering the numinous. I think this is what a lot of people mean by religious expression, our experience encountering the numinous. And, you know, by the numinous, I mean it's that thing that causes us to see with awe something of mystery and maybe also terror, you know. So that's the idea, and that's how it's been traditionally communicated. So the numinous, so you come into the presence of the holy, basically. I think that's how a lot of us understand what religion is. It's whatever puts us into the presence of the thing that we regard as holy. And in that moment, we experience, I use the word transcendent a lot to make the point, because we, you know, the transcendent shouldn't be encounterable here. But in religion, we encounter it anyway. And so I prefer the word transcendent a lot when I talk about it. It's not the greatest word for theologians for me. I end up having to have long discussions about why I choose that word. But it makes the point for me. Anyway, the numinous, I think, may be one of the ways we understand it. And that can be true for people who have a literal and genuine encounter with the one true God that I believe in. And it may be true for people who are having encounters that they wouldn't identify with that God's name. And yet, maybe it's the same God. You know, and I don't mean by that I'm a pluralist and you believe in whatever you want to believe. But I mean, maybe God's hunting them down. There are lots of ways in people who believe in one specific religion, like me, explain these things, but there are certainly people around the world who describe experiences that are numinous in one way or another, or encounters with the numinous one way or another, and we regard that as a religious experience. And sometimes we say, oh, well, maybe in the words of Paul, it's an angel of light, or they're pretending to be an angel of light when they're not, and so on. Any of that would fit it, but the experiential side of it would be those encounters with the numinous. By the way, I really like that definition, that understanding of what religion is, because the truth of the matter is, the people I know who have an encounter with the numinous, the people I know who in prayer or in a moment of quietude encounter this thing that is ineffable for them. They don't know exactly how to describe it. And it in a singular moment, terrorizes them and also leaves them in awe, in wonder, in reverence. They don't ever walk away from that. There's something about it that sticks with them. I value that. Obviously, I'm talking about my own experiences as well. So experientially, you know, religion can be understood that way. And parenthetically, let me just point out that I have to say this because we get this so wrong on this issue. Christianity may be distinct from other religions. I think it is. I believe it. I believe in its objective truth. But it's still a religion. And that old declaration that, you know, that it's not a religion, it's a relationship, is, you know, it's cheap. It's rhetoric, and it's catchy rhetoric. And so everybody repeats it all the time. But it's nonsensical. It misses the mark in at least two different ways. Number one, that it's not a religion. That's just false. It is a religion. We would just say it's the true religion. That's what we would say. But and on the definition of religion, that would be a false claim. But also based on the reasoning of the statement itself, that first part would be a false claim that it's not a religion. The dilemma itself would be false because nothing about the nature or essence of relationships precludes it also being a religion. What you're saying is it's not a religion. It's instead the thing that would make it not capable of being a religion. It's a relationship, as if a religion couldn't be a relationship. That's nonsensical. So on that basis, the idea that it's not a religion is not right. And on the second basis, because the relationship it defines is not simply one-on-one with God, but becoming part of a community of Christ in the world, and that community being in relationship with the Savior. My pastor was talking all through the sermon on Sunday about the fact that the bride of Christ is the church, not the individual. The whole beautiful point of it, that we're joining a community. That's what religion is about, as we were talking about earlier on. Anyway, pet peeve aside. So, why does religion persist? That's the question that remains, and that's what I want to address real quickly. So, there are a couple of takes that that I'll give on this. One is this. Our core being is just so stinking attuned. I just needed to put the word stinking in there. It is very dominantly attuned to the religious that we cannot help but encounter its object, the object of religion, the numinous or the holy or the guiding or the unifying, however you want to put it. And I want to read you this little section from a book, one of the very first short stories I ever read. I think I got this in Ann Miller's class at Baylor from when I was a student, you know, so 40-something years ago. And it's the short story called The Kiss by Richard Seltzer. And if you've never read it, it's just magnificent. It's beautiful. I'm reading you about half the story here. This is almost the whole story. I thought I still had a hard copy of this. I didn't. So I had to download it. So I'm hoping that the person who provided this online got it right. But they got the end right because I could never forget the end. I hope I can get through this. If I can't, Daisy, you can read the end for me. I stand by the bed. This is a surgeon. Richard Seltzer was a surgeon who also wrote this book, or wrote a book of short stories about his experiences in surgery. And he said, now, and I want to give you this as an example of how we can't get away from religious encounters. And again, he's not writing this neutral. He knows what he's doing. He's a brilliant author. So he writes it beautifully. But he makes the point that all of us encounter at the end of this story. I stand by the bed, he said, where the young woman lies, the woman he had performed surgery on, her face, post-operative, her mouth, twisted in palsy, clownish. A tiny twig of the facial nerve, one of the muscles of her mouth, has been severed. She'll be that way from now on. I had followed with religious fervor the curve of her flesh. I promise you that. Nevertheless, to remove the tumor in her cheek, I had cut this little nerve. Her young husband is in the room. He stands on the opposite side of the bed, and together they seem to be in a world all their own in the evening lamplight. isolated from me, private. Who are they? I ask myself. He and this wry mouth that I have made, who gaze at and touch each other so generously. The young woman speaks. Will my mouth always be like this? She asks. Yes, I say, it will. It is because the nerve was cut. She nods and is silent. But the young man smiles. I like it, he says. It's kind of cute. All at once, I know who he is. I understand. And I lower my gaze. One is not bold in an encounter with the divine. Unmindful, he bends to kiss her crooked mouth, and I am so close I can see how he twists his own lips to accommodate to hers, to show her that their kiss still works. Now look, I'm not reading you that because the author didn't know what he was doing and religion happened to slip in there. He wrote a story about encountering the sacred in a surgical ward where a woman's life had been changed and yet her husband loved her in a messianic way. In a way that identified, accommodated with her. And it's a beautiful expression of that kind of love. But the fact that he goes to the religious, you know, with religious fervor, I practiced my surgery. But then even he, with his religious fervor, finds himself in a sacred space, so sacred that he has to look down when he realizes who he's seeing in this divine impression, and has to leave them to their, you know, holy of holies, where they're meeting behind the veil kind of thing. That description is so pervasive in literature everywhere. It is indicative of how we search for the sacred. We search for the presence of God in every form we can possibly find. When I read this story, by the way, and when I thought of it earlier, well, it was yesterday when I was thinking of it from having read it ages ago, I thought of our friend Alan Peets, who was on the broadcast with us as a surgeon a while back, and he's a writer now, and how those encounters for somebody in his profession are an opportunity that a lot of us think we don't have. But the truth is we have them everywhere. We don't have them in that dramatic a form. We don't have them with exactly the same context, but everywhere. And in literature, you see this, and in all the things you see on TV and movies and everywhere else, the Gothic and substitute cathedral architecture of our civic buildings or in museums or even police stations sometimes. The design of courthouses and hospitals are to mimic the setting of a church or a holy place where you can recover from your sin or your illness or your criminality or whatever it is. And it's why we identify, even when we're not aware of what they are, we identify with images of baptism. In, you know, in literature and in movies and in TV shows, constantly in moments of reflection or transformation, the character is standing in the rain or taking a shower or having to bathe or drowning and then waking up to realize there's something more important to live for. All of those baptism scenes, they're not always accidental, by the way. Authors do know what they're doing, but we're not even aware of it, and yet we understand what the implications are. Our treatment of awe-inspiring beauty with reverence is one of the evidences of how profoundly we need to encounter the sacred in this world, which, by the way, I think we have to learn to see through beauty, not just to see beauty. That is, at some point, you have to decide, and we'll talk about this decision in the very last sentence of today's episode. You know, we have to decide whether we stop at the stars or see past the veil of that beauty to its creator. And I've seen both happen, and I love to be under the stars. I've done an episode on how much I love astronomy and love to put out my telescope. I enjoyed it this last weekend. I love seeing the stars, but I love even more seeing past that beauty because of it, not in spite of it, but through that beauty, through that veil, to the place where God himself is, that encounter with the numinous that comes from the encounter with the beauty in a world that very often lacks that beauty. So we have a need, you know, which looks for all the world like it can only be satisfied by the thing toward which religion is always pointing us. And again, I'm keeping these answers generic to religion. I'm not trying to say, why does Christianity succeed? That would be a topic for a different day. I'm keeping the answers generically because even though I think there's a specific answer to Christianity, which would be much more directed to my own faith, that God doesn't just disappear, that in fact, he doesn't appear at all inclined to give up hunting us down with his grace. That would be my answer about Christianity. But in terms of religion, it's all still here. And I think the numinous is just persistently presenting itself to our consciousness in a way we can't ignore. So the thing that leaves us maybe a little terrified, but definitely awed, we want that holy encounter. And we find something. We always look for some way to encounter that thing toward which religion points us. We do it with music, we do it with visual arts, we do it with drama, we do it even with comedy, we do it with aesthetics of all kinds. And again, I have talked about those topics in different episodes. We did a whole series on art that I would encourage you, if you haven't heard it, go back and listen to that. And it would explain what I mean by that, how we want to encounter those things and we can see them in beauty or in aesthetics, even all the way down to comedy. But also, not only do we want to encounter the numinous, these are the things that, you know, we just want so much that we're always drawn toward these things, and they are what religion is pointing us toward. The community is one of those. And despite all our effort to make it so, the core of religion never remains private. People love to say it. I know, and I understand, and I'm not pretending that people don't have a private, very personal relationship with God that they where they encounter him in their closet, in private prayer, in private moments, Elijah on the mountainside, you know, the still small voice of God. I absolutely believe all of that. I've had those encounters. I know what that means. But religion as a whole is still community. And we need community. And the Enlightenment has brought us so powerfully to this idea of us existing in the end-all and be-all of our nature as individuals. We are so isolated, so lonely. The Love Song of J. Alfred Prufrock stuff that I had in a different episode. We have so much isolation and loneliness that religion is the thing that compels us back toward the community that wants to embrace us and in which we want to find an identity. We just don't know how to do it anymore. And religion rises up and says, here, I got you. Come over here. I've got you. And even when we're not wanting it to be religious, it finds religious expression in that community. So community is a big part of it. Narrative is a big part of it. Not to recognize that we're part of a meaningful narrative is so contradictory to human existence that we seem to lose our way altogether as humans when we don't have it. Even majestic attempts to describe a meta-narrative, you know, the big narrative, the meta-narrative, to find that meaning without an external source of significance, they inherently lead to some form of nihilism. I mean, there's nowhere else it could go. It's built into it. So it leads to some form of nihilism, emptiness, lostness. And in our long-term view, when we understand nihilism to be the end-all and be-all of who we are, what we are, then it makes it impossible to find real meaning in our short view. We can pretend, we can act like it, but we lose it. And I mean, a beautiful, a really powerful example of that. And I don't know which way the author means this. Xi Jinping, I don't know how to say the name because I don't speak Chinese. I'm not making fun of it. I'm trying to imitate the way I heard it in Audible when I listened to The Three-Body Problem, which is a brilliant sci-fi trilogy that I loved. I absolutely adored the whole thing. But as you read that book, you realize that what they're wrestling with is that question. Where on earth can we find the big narrative to put humanity into so that our lives can make sense again? That question is so fundamental to us that even in a society that values not reviving, resuscitating any form of religion that sort of provokes us with the idea that religious expressions, even desiring to seek that, are cultish and somehow harmful to society overall, is in its own writing seeking that meaning. It's impossible to get away from. The meaning we seek in our short-term view is evidence in itself of the nature that's built into us. We want to understand the bigger narrative we're a part of. And religion gives us an ability to do that. Again, I don't think religion is enough. I'm not pretending that. I'm a Christian. But if you want to ask the question, and I know we think this all the time because it seems like secularism would have pushed religion out of place by now. Why not? Why doesn't it? Because, as I've quoted Robert Browning many times, but a man's reach should exceed his grasp, or what's a heaven for? We need to see a narrative bigger than ourselves that we fit into, or we wouldn't even understand why we're here. That's why we have a heaven. That's why we have religion. And I don't mean that's the creation of religion from man's perspective. I mean, that's why it isn't going anywhere. It's not going to go away because we need it. And so let me explain that to you in this way. In the general sense, just drawing my conclusion here, I think religion just keeps on ticking because we want it and because we need it. Again, I'm not giving the answer, why does Christianity continue? That's a different thing altogether. Just religion, sociologically, why is it always going to be there? I think religion just keeps on ticking because we want it and we need it. Underneath that, obviously, I would think that's because God made us, so we would want it and need it, obviously. But that's not important at this point. For significance and purpose, we need it. For our own identity and connection with others, we need it because we know we didn't create all this and we'd kind of like to know who did. We need it. And listen, this is, I'm two sentences from ending, so I want you to get, we're on the landing because this is important and it's part of the point of the whole episode. Do those desires and needs prove that our religion is true? No. But I have faith that they do. I have faith that they actually point us toward the truth. Do those desires and needs prove religion is false? They're just a selfish projection. Religion is just wish fulfillment in Freud's language. No, it doesn't prove that. But I've met plenty of people who have faith that it actually does prove that in some way. And perhaps that is the general reason I'm saying religion persists. Because regardless of the forces we encounter for it or against it, we are always inevitably and necessarily left in a position requiring that we choose one way or the other by, there it is, faith.
Thanks for joining us for Coffee with Creamer. Your cup of coffee may be finished, but we are not. Come back next week for a refill as we sit down to examine a new set of ideas and cultural issues. Don't miss an episode. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts or visit our website at barrycreamer.com. Until next time, keep your mug hot and your mind sharp.